you think of the Addams Family, admit it, you probably think of Gomez and Morticia and Uncle Fester. Yeah, I do too. But in a more serious frame of mind, of course, you think of John Addams and perhaps of Abigail Addams and perhaps of her very famous statement to her husband that he should remember the ladies and do something for them as he was adopting the Declaration of Independence with his members of the Second Continental Congress. But did you know that there was a second Mrs. Addams, the wife of John Quincy Addams, who's been often overlooked by historians, but who's the subject of a new biography by a woman named Louisa Thomas? And it turns out that Louisa Addams, the wife of John Quincy Addams, was not only a fascinating figure in her own right, but she wrote all about it. It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week it's all about the second Mrs. Addams.
Welcome to your Weekly Constitutional, hosted by Professor Stuart Harris and produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier.
Louisa Addams was a First Lady of the United States. She was the wife not of John Addams, but of John Quincy Addams. And she was a fascinating and often overlooked character in our American history. She started off as an Englishwoman. She married John at a relatively young age, John Quincy, that is, and she accompanied him on a rollicking career that took her to many of the great capitals of Europe, including Russia. And she did lots of adventurous things, including taking a trip across Russia during the middle of the War of 1812. But I get ahead of the story. The key here is that she wrote about all of these things. And recently, author Louisa Thomas read Louisa Addams's writings and has now produced a biography called, appropriately enough, Louisa.
I am a writer. I write historical nonfiction, biography, and I also write about sports and cultural criticism, things like that. I am now the author of a biography of Louisa Catherine Addams, John Quincy Addams' wife. It's called Louisa, The Extraordinary Life of Mrs. Addams, just out.
And I'm sure many people have noted the fact that you and Louisa share the same first name. Did that have anything to do with your decision to focus upon her?
As you can imagine, I am asked that quite a lot.
Right. And so I'm just being really trite and boring. That's what you're telling me very politely.
No. I mean, I only say that because I have had ample time to think about my answer. And so that if she had been named Jane, I might not have noticed her quite so quickly. There aren't a lot of Louises out there. So I certainly was maybe inclined to notice her because of her name. But that said, I don't think it extends too much beyond that. I do think if you're writing about a historical figure, you can't assume that you can get inside their head. You can't even assume that you can stand at their elbow, but it sort of does help to be able to open a window into the room they're standing. And I think for me, her name might have been that.
Well, let's talk about the book then. Louisa Addams is not a household name. Probably only history buffs even know who the wife of John Quincy Addams was. But she does indeed have an extraordinary life, as you tell it. So I wonder if you could more or less start at the beginning. Tell us, who was this extraordinary woman?
She was born in London in 1775, just before the outbreak of the revolution across the ocean. And she grew up as many young kind of upper middle class girls in England grew up. She actually spent the revolution in France. Her father was an American patriot, a merchant who'd come to set up business in London. Her mother was British, though, and she was really raised as English, though she was told to think of herself as an American.
I was tempted to say that that must have been difficult or unusually difficult, but then I was reminded that many American families were of English stock, and many of them had either been born in Britain or were just a generation or so removed from it. So I guess her heritage was not that unusual during that time.
Well, it was and it wasn't. I mean, in 1775, everyone born in the United States was also born British.
Right, right.
You know, so she was not unusual in that regard. John Quincy Adams was born British.
Yeah, but I guess what I meant was they were actually born on British soil,
yes,
in the home country.
And it did make quite a difference. It's one thing to be told to think of yourself as an American. It's another thing to be an American who has never seen the United States, who goes to an English boarding school, who has English friends, who reads English books, who does meet quite a few Americans because they come to her house, but really is a, not, as John Quincy Adams would say to his mother, wholly American. And she felt her difference when she finally did come to the United States, not until she was 26 years old. And it would also be used against her during the campaign, but that was sort of to come. I mean, I think that in a lot of ways, I mean, her upbringing is a little bit out of a Jane Austen novel in some ways.
Tell us about that. I think people will find that very interesting.
As it happened, she was actually born the same year as Jane Austen.
What was that year again?
1775. She goes to a boarding school in a little village about 3 miles north of her parents' home in Tower Hill, which is right by the Tower of London. She learns to sing and embroider and speak bad French and to be an ornament, which was a compliment at the time. And she was raised to be married, you know, and so she comes home and went about her business of trying to find her husband. Of course, she had many sisters and they were all sort of supposed to marry Americans, which is not so easy. So they were very pretty. They were very decorative. They had wonderful voices, and they had a habit of entertaining the eligible young bachelors who came, music after dinner, and then they had great games about it. You know, the sisters would play amongst themselves and decide, you know, who was whose suitor, and they gave all their, you know, visitors nicknames. Colonel Trumbull, who had actually introduced her to John Quincy Adams, as it happens, who is now famous for some of the most iconic portraits of the Revolutionary era, was Colonel Terrible, and he was actually he was sort of smitten with Louisa himself. But Peter Jay was Patera Jay because of the way he was introduced once. They play lots of games, you know. One of the ways in which they sort of flirted with John Quincy when he first arrived is they called him Mr. Quiz and played dictionary games with him. And I mean, there was a lot of laughter. There was a lot of light, but it was also very high stakes. Because really the only option for a woman was, I mean, if she was not going to become a governess, it was to marry or to be a spinster. And that was really her only job.
That's a very significant point you make, Louisa, and it's been made to me by other women. In fact, it was made to me in the context of talking about either Austen novels or maybe something by the Bronte sisters. Almost every woman I've ever met loves those novels. And during a conversation about them once, I admitted that I had tried some Austen and that I had found it really, really boring. And in fact, even silly, a lot of the stuff, the game playing and all the rest of it. And then it was pointed out to me rather pointedly, this was deadly serious stuff. This was the only game in town in the most serious of senses. And that, you know, it wasn't simply girls being girls and doing silly, irrelevant things. This is deadly serious stuff. And this was going to determine these women's entire future.
It's so interesting. I went back and read all the Austen novels while writing this book. And, you know, I noticed something that I really hadn't appreciated before. I had, you know, when I read them in high school and in college, I'd sort of read them as romantic novels, you know, kind of the way you'd watch a romantic comedy. When you read them, though, with a kind of mind for like trying to learn, you know, what was in the air of the time, what you notice is they're all about money.
Yeah.
And that was actually crucially important for me to understand where Louisa was coming from, because Louisa actually, her father went bankrupt right after she married John Quincy.
This
was devastating events in her life. I mean, she never really recovered from it in some ways. In the beginning, I thought this is she's a little bit crazy. You know, like, why is she taking this so seriously? Like, what is the wound here? What else is going on? I sort of assumed that it was about something else. And of course it was, because everything is always about something else. But it was also about money, you know, and because, you know, when you go back, you read Jane Austen, everyone has a price tag attached. All marriages are alliances.
And even the emphasis on manners and clothing and furnishings, these are all indicators of wealth and status.
Right. So, I mean, when you realize that, when you realize this is a business, it's not so silly. None of it is.
Wow. So Louisa's whole young adulthood was one of these comedies of manners.
Exactly. You know, and so a bachelor does come along.
Right.
He is the son of the vice president of the United States.
Pretty good catch.
Exactly. They sort of laugh at him at first because he's not fashionable. He dresses badly and he's sort of serious and kind of inscrutable and fickle. Mm-hmm. They decide that he is courting the oldest sister, Nancy. And then one day he hands a poem to Louisa and she sort of starts, you know, as it becomes increasingly clear that he's after her.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and today I'm speaking with author Louisa Thomas about her new book, Louisa, The Extraordinary Life of Mrs. Adams. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and speak some more with Louisa Thomas. Stick around. Doug, the quiz guy, Smith, is to my left. He is looking spry today.
I didn't know anyone could be to your left. Hello, Stuart. How are you?
What do you mean? I'm not the sort of lefty liberal like you. You're the lefty liberal
That's
guy.
That's why I'm here to balance you. Make America great again.
To make America great again. Okay, tremendous. Mm-hmm. I think America is great now. What do you well, do we have someone on the line? And do you think America is great, whoever you are?
Yes, you do. And yes, I do.
Tremendous. And who are you, sir?
Jesse from Greenville, Tennessee.
Greenville, Tennessee, which is just down the road from Johnson City, which is right near WETS, where we broadcast. I bet that's where you listen to us, isn't it?
That's correct.
Tremendous. Well, are you ready for a quiz?
Let's do it.
Let's do it, he says, Doug. That sounds pretty confident to me.
Here we go, Jesse. I'm going to give you a question and four choices. Are you ready?
Yes, I am.
How many Supreme Court justices does the Constitution call for?
How many? Oh, wow.
How many Supreme Court justices does the Constitution call for? Is it A, 6 justices, B, 7 justices, C, 9 justices, or D, it does not stipulate?
Mm.
Well, I know the number of justices on the court has changed over the years, so I'm going to go with D. It doesn't call for it.
It doesn't. What about, but we've had 9 justices for like 100 and some odd years. That's not a requirement of the Constitution?
But I seem to recall that in the 40s or maybe the late 30s that FDR tried to pack the court with his liberal judges. And I believe that there's no constitutional requirement that there be 9. I think they're just requires that there be a Supreme Court.
I think we have a scholar on the line, Doug.
Jesse, if you find yourself in Orange, Virginia, where Montpelier is located, please plan to take a tour on me. You are exactly right. Not only does the Constitution not stipulate it, but FDR did try to pack the court.
Yes.
With up to 15 members, but Congress didn't go for it.
Jesse, you should have seen Doug here. He was sort of doing his happy dance in the studio. He didn't want to give the answer away, but when you started mentioning the court packing plan, I think that's where he was planning on going anyway. So congratulations. You win a T-shirt and send us an email at ywc@montpelier.org. Give us your size and your address. We'll send it to you with a pocket constitution. But let's go back and talk a little bit about that court packing plan, because FDR was, perhaps rightly, criticized for overreach. He had just won the election of 1936. He had an overwhelming Democratic majority in both houses of Congress. And in fact, he'd won an overwhelming electoral victory. So he pretty much controlled 2 branches of the national government. And then he wanted to take over that third because that very conservative court had been knocking down so much of his New Deal.
Mm-hmm. That's right. He did by age. Do you remember that?
Right, he did. Over 70, wasn't
everybody
it?
Over 70. You know, once there was someone over 70, you could add someone else to the court because they're appointed for life.
Right.
But, you know, part of what I guess was in his mind was that, you know, once you're over 70, you're probably not able to be an active and good court member.
Well, that's what he said.
Yeah,
that's what he said.
It's all about New Deal politics.
I think it was probably all about getting his own majority. And even though perhaps he was rightly criticized for this, it was perfectly constitutional.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because it's Congress, the one that sets. I mean, the number of justices has ebbed and flowed, grown and shrunk over time. But since about 1869, it's been at the 9 mark.
Right.
And that's where we have it today. Well, we have it 8 today, because we're waiting on Congress to take action on the president's nominee.
But they have Congress could change it at any time, what they want to do. And that's another interesting gloss on this, is that even though they've authorized 9 seats, they don't technically have to fill them, or at least that's an issue that we're currently dealing with. It seems as if Congress doesn't have to fill those, or doesn't have to confirm any of those. But that's kind of another issue.
That'd be an interesting case to be pled before the Supreme Court. Oh!
Yeah, I don't know if they would take that case. Well, Jesse, at any rate, thank you very much for playing. Excellent analysis, excellent answer. You win.
Well, thank you for having me on.
All right, and thank you, Doug.
Hey, you bet, Stuart. It's the Constitution. We read it for the articles.
You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now it's time to continue our discussion with author Louisa Thomas, who's written a book called Louisa, The Extraordinary Life of Mrs. Adams. It's not about Abigail Adams. That's the Adams wife that you've heard about. That's the first lady you've heard about. This is one perhaps you haven't heard about. And Louisa, the wife of John Quincy Adams, started life as an Englishwoman. We heard about her youth in the first part of our show. And we were just hearing about the meeting between John Quincy Adams and Louisa and the revelation that John Quincy Adams had decided that he was going to court the young Englishwoman.
He didn't come to London to get married, and he certainly didn't come to London to get married to someone who was born in London. He was raised in the kind of American household.
Sure.
And he knew that he was expected to do great things for his country, and that falling for a somewhat English girl who clearly was comfortable in a certain level of luxury, not ostentatious, but oil portraits on the wall and a harp in the corner and servants. There were 11 servants in her household. And
I think you might call that ostentatious. Or
By standards of the aristocracy, it was not so much. But by the standards of the Adams family farm back in Quincy, it was pretty nice life.
You touched on a couple of things I'd like to mention there, if you wouldn't mind, please. First of all, John Quincy Adams, though we're certainly not focused on him during this discussion, but we nonetheless have to acknowledge that he was an extraordinary figure. He's from, you know, of course, the son of John Adams and Abigail Adams, and he had been groomed since earliest childhood, essentially for the presidency, and he followed his father all over the globe. And I recently heard somebody say that Hillary Clinton is one of the most qualified presidential candidates in terms of her actual experience. If you look at her resume and the number of countries she's visited, I suspect Quincy Adams actually exceeded her and pretty much everybody else.
Absolutely. I think that he probably was the most qualified president in history. I mean, ironic considering the kind of nepotism charges in some ways.
But he'd been like an executive training program for years.
Oh, yeah.
And was a fairly serious guy.
Well, you know, he sometimes gets a bad rap because he was so serious and he would come to get this reputation for being rather cold. But he did have a sense of humor, and Louisa brought it out in him, actually.
Very interesting. And I'm just curious, when you see pictures of him from later in life, he wasn't exactly a movie idol type.
No, but there's a picture of him, and it's of him done around the time that he met Louisa, and it's stunning. Yeah, he's quite handsome.
John Quincy Adams, stud muffin? I had no idea.
He's so handsome. And you get it. And he was charming. He liked a good glass of wine. Mm-hmm. You know, he had more to him. But the interesting thing, even in that time, you know, he had so absorbed this kind of deep suspicion of pleasure that he just, it tore him apart that he was having such a nice time. In fact, he would sort of write in his diary, you know, I'm doing so terribly. This is awful. I need to get out of here. This is so nice. It's awful. You know, I'm having such a good time. What am I going to do? Make it stop. I mean, he saw temptation everywhere. And one of the temptations came in the form of a nice 20-year-old soprano.
Probably the greatest temptation of all. But I have to just mention one other parallel. Of course, the exact opposite of this was a few years earlier when Franklin went off to Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And he just embraced both Britain and France. And I remember there was a contrast when Adams joined him in France, with Adams's reaction to Franklin's lifestyle and his embrace of the French lifestyle. And Adams Sr., John Adams, did not like it. So it seems to be a little bit like father, like son.
Yes. Well, certainly John Quincy had absorbed his family's strictures against, you know, I mean, he was like 14 years old, 11 years old, going to France, and Abigail was writing him all these letters about how Europe was going to corrupt him. And sure enough, it did.
Okay, now back to Louisa. You mentioned that there was this contrast between European manners and American sensibilities generally, not just with the Adamses. And that's another theme, I think, that runs through this, is that the United States was very Republican with a small r.
Yeah.
And sort of prided itself on its relative simplicity and lack of opulence. Was that playing into this early relationship as well?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's not so much in that moment, but because I think that he kind of went with it when he was actually there. But once he left, they were engaged by the time he left. And he started writing her these letters that she thought she was like, what's going on? And they were lectures about how she had to get over her love of luxury and she's going to go live in the courts and America's not like that, and she's going to be corrupted, and, you know, and she's like, what are you talking about? I mean, he wasn't wrong, to be honest, but it was a kind of jarring thing to be told that, you know, she was susceptible and going to be in trouble, and America, like, she would just never fit in, and he would never have enough money to give her the things that she thought, you know, were going to come her way. And
did she ever at some point think to herself, I'm going to dump this stiff?
Oh, yeah. They had a kind of contentious back and forth where they were constantly sort of, they both knew how to wound each other.
Even during their courtship.
During their courtship, yeah.
And yeah, I'm kind of getting surprised that they actually got together, but go on.
So, you know, these letters are flying back and forth and they kind of always are, you know, going for the kill and then pulling back. He gave her an opportunity to say no. He said, you know me now. You know what I can offer. If you decide to pull out, you know, I will not judge you for it. You know, and she told him to come. It would have been a big deal to pull out because not so hard to find eligible Americans. Mm-hmm. And also there was.
And it was her father pushing her to marry an American, right?
Right. Although her mother probably pushed her to marry John Quincy harder than her father. Her father wanted her to marry a Southerner. He's from Maryland.
Mm-hmm. Also, not just an American, but a Southerner. So
yeah,
must have been disappointed with the Adamses of Massachusetts.
I take it, though. Mm-hmm. And her mother definitely was like, come on, come on.
Okay. So, but nobody wanted her to marry an Englishman.
No. No one wanted her to marry an Englishman.
Even though they've been living in England all these years.
Even though they've been living in England. It was, you know, her father's brother was he was the governor of Maryland. I mean, he was a patriot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he would definitely conceive of himself as an American.
I wonder why they didn't take, I guess their own business kept them in Britain.
That's where the money was.
Yeah.
And I also think his wife, he was a little bit reluctant to bring her. There's a whole backstory there, which we could get into. They didn't actually get married until Louisa was 10, which is a secret.
Oh, my. Rather a scandal.
It was a scandal. Although I think they were accepted as married in British society. They just passed, which is not that uncommon. Mm-hmm. But his brothers knew. His family knew.
I see. Well, okay. So there were reasons they didn't simply relocate to the United States, which of course would make sense. If you want to marry an American, you go where the Americans are. But that explains it to some extent.
To some extent. And he was the American consul in England. I mean, they had a nice life.
Okay.
Britain. You know, it was nice. He was always talking about going home, constantly talking about going home, but just never did it until, of course, he went bankrupt and they fled.
Mm-hmm.
They fled their creditors and went to Georgetown.
And did that happen right around this time, or was that later?
2 weeks after Louisa and John Quincy got married.
Oh, my.
And the creditors come and knock on her door.
Oh, my.
And his door, more to the point. And it was just deeply traumatic, like I was saying.
I guess it was, but I interrupted your narrative. You said she went finally to America.
Right. So at this point, so I'm going to not to skip over things. So they go to Prussia. Mm-hmm. She's a success there. She's charming. She's lovely. She speaks French because she lived in France.
I'm sorry. I interrupted you again. When you say they went to Prussia, it was just before or after the marriage?
Right after they get married.
Okay. And where did they get married?
In London.
Okay. So John Quincy Adams comes back to London. They get married there. Mm-hmm. And then we already know that about 2 weeks later, there's this bankruptcy that happens. And that's devastating. But then roughly at the same time or very soon thereafter, the young Adamses head off to Prussia.
Very soon after they head off to Prussia.
Okay. Well, that was kind of nice for Louisa to get away from the scandal of the bankruptcy.
Although at the same time, she's now separated from her family, you know, her best friends, you know, it's that in and of itself is not easy to bear. Mm-hmm.
She's a success in Prussia.
And, she befriends the queen, you know, she sort of does very well. She comes to Quincy and Abigail Adams greets her with profound suspicion.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Had Abigail come to London for the wedding?
Actually, Abigail had, John Adams had been the minister in London. They'd met the Johnsons there. Mm-hmm. And Abigail, when she kind of gets wind that John Quincy's courting this, one of the Johnson sisters, she figures out, first of all, who it is. She guesses. Mm-hmm. And she writes, you know, I hope for the love I bear my country, the siren is at least half blood, which is just amazing.
Siren. Okay.
Siren. Exactly. So you have some sense of, you know, what's going to come. Mm-hmm. Let's just say it does not go smoothly. Louisa later writes, she treats her like a, quote, fine lady, which is like a, you know, which Louisa wanted to be in some ways and was not good for the family farm. And she's, you know, she sort of serves her separate food, more delicacies than everybody else. And she calls her Mrs. Adams, even though she's calling, you know, the other women around by their first names. You know, she just marks her as different. It was both kind of, and it sort of scared Louisa into silence and submission. And, you know, it just did not go well at first. They later came to have quite a good relationship. But for a long time it was rough. I mean, Abigail was really tough on her and Louisa was kind of shy and haughty. And incompetent in some ways. She just, you know, she wasn't kind of raised to take care of the home. She was raised to sort of order the servants around.
And there weren't a lot of servants.
There weren't a lot of servants. Right. I mean, there were servants, actually. It's sort of a myth that there weren't. But they tended to be, you know, young women from Quincy, you know, mm-hmm. you know, who were trying to make a little money for their family or whatever. I mean, they were not servants. There wasn't a servant class in the same way.
Mm-hmm. So this is roughly in the 1790s. She's over in Quincy, right?
This is the early 1800s.
Early 1800s. Okay. So she's in Quincy. Are they all living under one roof at this time?
They for a while. And then they moved to Boston. Mm-hmm. She's relieved to get out.
Oh, I was thinking that it had to be quite a relief.
Yeah,
for everybody.
She was totally relieved. Mm-hmm. So she sort of settles into Boston and almost immediately John Quincy, who's always forsworn politics, gets the bug and they move to Washington where he enters the Senate. Mm-hmm. And from there, it's basically a story about both her exposure to political life in Washington, but also, I mean, she is so itinerant. They're going back and forth between Washington. In 1809, he's appointed the minister to Russia. They go to St. Petersburg.
That must have been an adventure.
This is the same year as the War and Peace.
Right.
So she is in the court of, you know, these women are dripping with diamonds. You know, it's a pretty amazing scene. And she gets to know the Tsar. Partly because she brings her sister with her, and he has a bit of a wandering eye, and it lands on Kitty Johnson. So yeah, it was full of adventures, and it was a hard time in a lot of ways. She was separated from her sons, mm-hmm. who were left behind.
Yeah, that was one of the themes you mentioned in the book, is that it was John Quincy Adams who didn't want to bring the kids, and she was more inclined to have them with her, right?
Yeah, she didn't want to leave them alone. Mm-hmm. And you know, the ones that they left, so Charles Adams did come with them, but the mm-hmm. two that didn't went on to have pretty sad ends, and she blamed herself and blamed her husband.
Mm-hmm. Now, just if you could, what three sons?
They had three sons.
Okay. Did they have any daughters? I think one, right?
They did have a daughter in Russia, and she died.
Oh.
In Russia. It was mm-hmm. really sad story, actually.
Okay. So they had a total of four children, and of the three boys, Charles was the oldest, right?
No, Charles was the youngest.
Forgive me, I misspoke.
No worries.
So Charles was the youngest, so they left the older two back in the United States. And what were their names?
Their names were George and John.
Okay, and things didn't go very well for them.
They did not go very well. One of them would go on to die. He would either fall or jump over a steamship boat. Mm. And the other would die of alcoholism, both young.
Not very happy.
The effects of alcoholism, I should say. Not very happy. And she was wrenched by this. It was really hard, obviously. She was very close to them.
Yeah, that's the sort of thing that can bust up a marriage. I imagine it caused quite a bit of tension between John Quincy and Louisa.
You know, it did, but at the same time, it brought them back together in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
During the White House years, well, let me back up for
mm-hmm.
a second.
Sure.
You know, so they come back from Russia. He's Secretary of State, or come back from Britain. They go to Britain after Russia.
Wait a second. You can't skip over her you can't skip over her trip through the snow, though.
Okay.
But you'll have to wait a minute or two to hear about that famous trip across the snows of Russia, because now we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll have our Madison Minute. But I promise you, then we'll speak some more with Louisa Thomas about her book about Louisa Adams. Stick around.
Other president has been as reluctant and ill-prepared for war as was James Madison. Madison had neither the personality nor temperament usually associated with a good wartime leader, and his political philosophy, which so much informed the structure and spirit of the Constitution, was diametrically opposed to a strong and independent executive and a highly armed and organized national military. It was Madison, however, unimposing in stature, quiet and aloof in disposition, cautious and deliberative in thought, ideologically opposed to standing armies and navies, and morally abhorrent of defense as an excuse for unchecked executive power, who led America into its first declared war, the War of 1812. America was thoroughly unprepared for war, militarily, economically, and psychologically, with one of America's most bumbling and conniving executive cabinets, and a field command which was overaged and incompetent. Madison took America to war against the greatest superpower of that time. The winner? The U.S. Constitution. With your Madison Minute, I'm Jen Patia Howell.
And now it's time to finish our discussion with author Louisa Thomas, all about her new book on Louisa Adams, the wife of John Quincy Adams. And it turns out that Louisa Adams led quite a life. She was quite an adventurous soul, and she wrote all about her experiences, which provided marvelous source material for Louisa Thomas. And when we left our tale, John Quincy was in Paris. Louisa was in St. Petersburg, all the way in Russia, and between them was the War of 1812.
And then, you know, he writes and says, okay, why don't you come join me in Paris? Pack up our things or sell them and come.
And she's at the tail end of the War of 1812.
She does not speak yeah, Moscow's just like been set on fire, you know, Napoleonic Wars.
Right.
And she does not speak Russian. You know, she's sort of a mark. I mean, this is not the Tsarist Russia is not the most like above board society either. You know, you have to deal with a lot. And it's rough, and she does it, you know, and she is deeply insecure, deeply, deeply insecure. But she is just awesome. She does it. She packs everything up. She buys a carriage. She hires servants. Da da da. Two male servants to protect her. One female kind of maid to take care of Charles. And then off they go, 2,000 miles across the Russian winter landscape. As it starts to thaw, they abandon the sled. She gets halfway there and she learns that Napoleon has escaped Elba and is converging as she is on Paris. Her male servants flee in fear. She is crossing battlefields that are still strewn with wreckage. She's talking to women who are telling her stories of rampage and rape. Soldiers are mustering. I mean, this is terrifying. She has no guidance, no guidance at all. She never hears from her husband. She waits in certain places. She would wait a couple of extra days, hoping a letter would arrive. Nothing. She goes on. People are telling her to stop. She goes on. And she, you know, at one point she impersonates Napoleon's sister. I mean, she's amazing. She's totally amazing.
And she recorded all of this in a memoir about their trip, didn't she?
Not only that, she didn't just recognize that it was a great adventure. She saw that it was something that could help other women, something that she could use to show something of her character. She wrote it, she said, to remind people that she was, quote, one who was, and also to show what women could do.
Yeah, she was quite the feminist.
She was. You know, it's interesting. She was not a feminist. I have to be very careful about that.
Okay, well, please correct me.
She had absorbed a lot of the strictures of her day. She never would have called herself a feminist. She never would have thought her place was anywhere but in the home. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, and she also used, you know, she used the word masculine in a kind of derogatory way. But at the same time, she would kind of go back and forth. She was really drawn to strong women. She was a voracious reader.
Well, she thought men and women were at least intellectually equal.
Intellectually equal, yes.
Right.
She did. And she would sort of equivocate sometimes, but that's always where she would end up.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of a radical thing.
Yeah, she was pretty radical for her time. My.
Yeah, and this is something she sort of came toward late in her life. It was one of the ways in which she grew. And she really grew. I mean, I think that this is the thing. People ask me, you know, what most interests you about her sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it's how much she grew even late in her life.
Well, she certainly had lots of fodder for growth, including this fascinating trip across war-torn, war-ravaged Europe. And there was no GPS then.
No GPS. That is right.
And very little support, it seems like. But eventually she makes it to Paris.
Eventually she makes it to Paris.
And then what happens after that?
After that, she... it kind of collapses.
Uh-huh.
But after that, sorry, it's always interesting whenever she's tested, you know, she rises to the occasion. Whenever she's sort of allowed to fall apart or thought, you know, whenever people think she'll fall apart, she does. So they go to England where they have where he's the foreign minister and they have kind of an idyllic family life for a couple of years, and then it's back to the United States where he's appointed Secretary of State, which at that time is the heir apparent, makes him the heir apparent to the presidency.
Mm-hmm.
And he will never admit that he is campaigning because campaigning is craven.
Right.
She is really the one who campaigns. And she does it by holding this kind of series of parties. They're called Tuesday and Mrs. Adams. She really understands how crucial relationships are.
Mm-hmm.
And she forms them. It turns out that being a fine lady is actually really an asset.
Right.
You know, in Washington.
This is in the 18-teens, right?
Yes. And okay. So she's a great success.
Mm-hmm.
And the 1824 election comes around and John Quincy Adams wins, but the White House, you know, she had this great role
Before we get to the election of 1824, let's just, I have to note the similarity between her and her near contemporary Dolly Madison, who was
it's funny. They had a kind of wary relationship, partly, I think, because they were sort of successes in the same way.
Okay, please. Well, did they actually know each other?
Yeah, they knew each other a little bit. They were not friends. Louisa admired Dolly very much. Everybody loved Dolly. Mm-hmm. Everybody loved Dolly, including Louisa in some ways. You know, Dolly, after one ball, you know, she wrote a friend, you know, I hear Mrs. Adams is keeping up the taste for dissipation.
Oh, my.
She's a bit catty, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's an old story. People who are very similar see each other as rivals. And the older ones.
They weren't quite rivals because by that time, you know, Dolly was in Montpelier.
Right.
Remember. But yeah, they did know each other, and it is an old story. I mean, it's very familiar. I mean, as is, you know, I was sort of giving Abigail a hard time. The mother-in-law dynamic is another timeless thing, it turns out.
Yeah, these are very, very recognizable patterns here. Okay, so finally we get through the teens. She's been helping John Quincy all through his rise through the American government, and now he's Secretary of State, and they go into the election of 1824. And tell me about that, please.
She is coordinating for him. She is, you know, encouraging him to reach out to his supporters. He sort of refuses to do any of it. She calls it my campaign. She calls her parties my campaign. And it really, in some ways, was her campaign. But then she gets to the White House, and there's really nothing for her to do. There was really no kind of like, it wasn't like now, you know, where, you know, the first lady kind of adopts her causes, you know, childhood obesity or whatever. You know, she was sort of, she hosted levees, these parties kind of once every 2 weeks. That was it. She sort of was stuck in her room and ate chocolate and felt lonely. And she and her husband had a really hard time. I mean, they were almost estranged. And that was probably their toughest period. And in some ways, the death of George, which happens almost immediately after he leaves the White House, brings them back together. So rather than tearing them apart, they actually really, even though she's devastated and does blame him in some ways and blame herself, you know, they support each other. I mean, and there was real love in their marriage. I mean, not to skip too far ahead, but you know, if you read the kinds of things she was writing right before he died, and saw how absolutely devastated she was by just the idea that he would leave her, you know, in death, you would have understood, you know, just how close they were in these important ways.
Well, so he leaves the White House because he was a one-term president.
Yep.
And so after 4 years of this relative estrangement and, of course, followed by the death of their son, what are they doing? Where do they go after the White House?
They go back to Quincy, and she thinks that they're going to sort of live out their days there. And he kind of gives a silent nod, a wink or whatever, the efforts to put him to Congress. She is furious. She is like, you are not going to do this to me and your family. No, we have sacrificed too much. But
that's understandable. But let's just pause there. People might not realize this, that he's, if not the only president, certainly one of the very few who's ever gone back and held an office in Congress after being president.
He's the only one, right? He's not. I mean, there have been judges passed,
right,
you know, for instance.
But actually, being a member of Congress, he's the only one, which seems quite a come down today. I mean, it would be almost unthinkable, for example, for President Obama to run for Congress in Illinois or wherever he's going to end up a few years from now.
It's not the same thing back then. No, it's not the same thing. Also, he doesn't run, you know, for Congress. This is, again, a difference. He sort of just allows himself to be put up for it.
And Congress was much smaller then.
Congress was much smaller. Yep, of course it was smaller. The country was smaller.
Right, and so proportionately much more powerful.
And also, you know, he is, again, remember that he has been raised to think that no service is too small.
Mm-hmm.
And he takes it as a kind of huge triumph, as great as any triumph he's ever had. In fact, he writes.
To be elected to Congress after being the president.
Well, because he feels like the election that puts him out of office is a referendum on his service.
Mm-hmm.
And he feels like he's been rejected, and it's incredibly painful.
Right.
This is the time where she really starts writing, really. And she doesn't start writing, but her voice just takes off, and she thinks about, you know, what it means to be a woman, what it means. She's, you know, struggling through her thoughts on slavery, which are never quite what I want them to be, but, you know, people aren't, you know, but she's really kind of thinking and trying to figure out the right thing to do and the right way to live and how to have faith. And this is really where she becomes, you know, what you would call a proto-feminist.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an extraordinary time in her life, just as it is an extraordinary time in his life.
It is. It's just remarkable. Now, they spent a few years back in Massachusetts after he left office, because I think he left the presidency in 1829, right?
Yes.
And then when did he go back to Congress?
He's elected almost immediately. I think he's elected in 1830, but doesn't start until 31. I might be off by a year.
Okay, so it was a couple of years that they were back in Massachusetts.
And they go back and forth, you know, because there's these long, you know, it's typical to go back and forth. But it's an amazing story.
And that's pretty much how things end up then. They end up in Washington, D.C.? Or what happens later in their lives?
They end up, you know, going back and forth between Quincy and Washington,
mm-hmm.
As they always had. And, you know, a lot of time writing, grandchildren. They become, again, they have, again, periods of difficulty and then, again, periods in which they're just deeply close.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, John Quincy, she's still on fire. Like the letter she's writing just, you know, a week before John Quincy collapses on the floor of the house are some of my favorite letters.
Tell us about those, please.
She's just so with it. You know, it's like she's talking about, she's a very funny writer and she's just kind of making fun of everyone. No one is sacred,
right?
You know, like nothing is kind of beyond her. Kind of like she said, you know, she writes once, she's like, you have to have a pen of a Hogarth, you know, the great satirist, to write about Washington these days. And I'm like, dude, you do. It's great. I love it. You know, and then he dies and she kind of collapses. It's devastating to her.
Well, he was getting up there, wasn't he? He must have been close to 80.
There, and she knew he was going to die, and thought just wrecked her, and his death did wreck her in some ways. And she had a stroke soon after, and died herself in 1852. When she died, Congress adjourned. It was the first time that they had done that for a woman, actually. You know, it's a very moving thing, her funeral. What Charles, I'm actually almost about to start crying thinking about what Charles was writing about that time and what it was like for him and how he felt for the first time alone. You know, I mean, he's a grown man, a politician himself, quite accomplished by that point, and he just wrote about what her presence in his life meant and in his life and in the lives of so many.
Was their only surviving child.
Yeah.
So she really was, I mean, when she died, it wasn't just Louisa dying. It was the last of his immediate family.
Yes. I mean, he had children and stuff by that point.
Right.
He had his own, but it's, you know, it was devastating to him.
Well, what an extraordinary life. Have you drawn any grand lessons from it? Is there any relevance to modern Americans other than just fascinating history?
Of course, because there always is in the lives of, I mean, the times are so different that it's, and again, the conventions are so different. But at the same time, you know, I think, first of all, what I was saying about her growth just continues to stun me. You know, she was just constantly learning late into her life. She was learning. And the other thing I would say is that, you know, I think that we sort of place such a premium on confidence, mm-hmm. especially for women. You know, you have to be confident, you have to be fire, you know, you have to be lean in or whatever. She was deeply insecure. And some of her strength, that was a strength for her. That's where her strength came from. She had a kind of preternatural sensitivity, you know, for how people were feeling, including herself. She was very emotional. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it also allowed her to recognize tests as tests. You know, she sort of looked herself and said, I'm not up to it. And then she had to find the strength. I mean, it kind of gave to me insecurity a good name, not a good name, but it made me think that, you know, people are complicated, you know, and that we should sort of respect their complexity.
And maybe a dose of insecurity isn't all that bad.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
You know, confidence certainly can be a virtue, but overconfidence can be a weakness.
Yes.
And apparently
that's
she didn't.
Showing your feelings, you know, mm-hmm. that's something that I think that we, you know, John Quincy Charles once said, wore an iron mask. You know, he hid his feelings so effectively. Mm-hmm. She really encouraged her to take it off.
Hmm. Well, before we leave this, what happened with Charles? He was their only remaining child who outlived them. Did he have a good life?
He went on to become a diplomat as well, mm-hmm. and a politician. And he did have a pretty, he was kind of became a little bit of a Victorian prude in some ways, to be mm-hmm. honest. But his son, Henry Adams,
right.
Became the great historian. And Henry knew Louisa and was fascinated by her.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He writes about his autobiography and how much he used to love to go in her room and just look at her. And how he didn't really understand what he would later learn, that, you know, that maybe this sort of spark of rebellion against the Puritan, cold, harsh Adams manners came from her. But later on, he, you know, really kind of before he became the Henry Adams that we all know, he thought he might publish her papers, and he actually copied out hundreds of pages. You can go see them at Houghton Library. And
right.
I actually think that he learned quite a bit from her.
Because she did leave quite a record. And in fact, that was the basis for much of your book, wasn't it? It wasn't just that memoir from Russia.
Thousands of pages.
Right.
I mean, she was, in some ways, she was so accessible because she did write so much about her feelings, which was quite rare. And because she wrote so much, and part of the story is about her becoming a writer, really.
And that's quite a treasure trove for any biographer to find.
Yeah.
That. Did you realize that she had left such a record before you began this project, or was that just a happy discovery once you started your research?
Well, I discovered it through her letters. So
okay.
I read some of them, but I didn't know how many there were, certainly. And that was a gift. I mean, at first it was like, oh my gosh, what am I going to do? How am I going to deal with this? But of course, it was a gift.
Well, Louisa Thomas, thank you very much for sharing with us your biography of Louisa Adams and of her extraordinary life. And we thank you very much for talking to us today.
Thank you for having me on.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Louisa Thomas for that fascinating interview. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by the Fifes and Drums of Colonial Williamsburg. Our Madison Minute is by Jen Patia Howell of the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment.